Thank you for keeping the flies fly.
Vibes Lives has something very special for you right after church, gospel brunch, and sunshine. I am Robin Lynn, and join me for Jazz with Jay every Sunday and a glass of wine on VibesLive.com, 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com.
So nice, so that's what I like.
I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. If you've been following us, and I know you have, you find that Disco Daddy's been taking you down the yellow brick road of hip hop. And doing our research, we found that a lot of people out there who love hip hop really do not know the history. They don't know how hip hop started, the progression of hip-hop from the B-boys, the B-girls, to the DJs, and then the MCs, adding on beatbox and graffiti being added on later. There is a history of hip-hop. Not only is there a history of hip-hop from the time it started being called hip-hop, which is a term created by Keith Cowboy Wiggins in New York City, but there's a history of hip-hop before recorded records. There's a history that goes back to the time the foundation for what we now know as hip-hop was being laid. These are first-generation pioneers, and the man that's a guest on my show today is a true first-generation pioneer. East Coast or West Coast, it does not matter. First generation is a period starting around 1970 leading up to 1983. Anybody who was doing anything hip-hop related, even before the term hip-hop was coined, is a first-generation hip-hop legend. This is Grandmaster Alonzo. Alonzo Williams.
What's up, Pat?
Now, many people know you from the World Class Wrecking Crew, but you have a history that predates that. I'm familiar with it. My audience is not. So today, my brother, we're going to turn the mic over to you. It is your story, your role in hip-hop, how you ended up in it, and how you started out where you were born and raised. And I'm going to sit back, and we're going to listen to Grandmaster Alonzo on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop.
Hey, Disco Daddy, thank you for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it. I thank everybody for taking time out to listen to this show. You know, my history in West Coast hip-hop or in hip-hop started back in 1973, 72. Actually, I got my first glimpse of it and back in the late 60s when I was in junior high school. I went to a what they call a sock hop back in the day, and the DJ was from a radio station. He was we were at Captain of the Park in Compton. And he had the crowd rocking. He had the crowd just rocking. And he was playing Ohio Players Pain, okay? And he was playing the long version. And if you have to go back and dig, this one of the records only Disco Daddy right now I can appreciate. And it was one of the first long versions I ever heard. And back then, when you had a party going, people would be dancing in syncopation. Everybody would be doing the same thing. We had this little groove, and the whole room we grooving together. And if you ever watch Soul Train, you'll see that same group syncopation on Soul Train where everybody is going down at the same time, or everybody's rocking to the same way at the same time, and it's just such a smooth groove. And I saw him create that vibe. I wanted to learn how to do that. And at that time...
Look, that was your first basic introduction and sort of impression where you the light bulb came on that this is what Grandmaster Lonzo wanted to do.
Right. So I wanted to become a DJ. I wanted to be a street DJ. But at that time, the only DJs that were around were DJs for radio stations. So I thought you had to be a radio DJ first to become a street DJ. So not knowing that one day I'd have an opportunity to become a radio DJ, when I got to high school, I still had to drive. I still went to all my school sock hops, and the DJs were whack. They never did do what Homeboy did. I didn't see much of that again. And then when I got around the 12th grade, they had right before I graduated, they passed around this book, and it was career opportunities, and they asked you, what do you want to do? And it allowed me to check off radio. I checked off radio and something else. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from a broadcast school, Don Tracy School of Broadcasting in Los Angeles. They gave me a scholarship, and it was a 6-month course, and they guaranteed if you pass this class, you get a third-class broadcast license.
They were a premier school at that time here in L.A.
Oh, man, yeah. They were right there in Crenshaw, where the mall is, right across the street from the mall. Kaiser sits there now. But, you know, we're talking about 76, 1976. Yeah. I'm fresh out of high school.
You took me way back with that, Don Tracy.
I'm fresh out of high school, and the disco era was cracking. And I'm playing Fly Robin Fly. I'm playing Donna Summer. I'm playing. That's why I got my DJ teeth cut on. Okay, got out of high school. Got out of broadcast school, and didn't have there were no real black discos. And some of my buddies started giving dances at that time because there were no black discos.
Right.
And I eventually worked my way. Hustled my way into becoming a disco DJ, okay? And I started in the park. I didn't have all the experience unnecessary, so I would go out to the park and just set up in the park and play.
What year were we talking about right there? What year are
we talking about? We're talking about 76, 77 now, okay?
Okay.
I would go out in the park, and because I'm mechanically inclined, I knew how to find electricity at the park. And basically, most of the time, if you go to a public restroom, there is no outlets. But if you look on the floor, on the ground, you'll see a flat plate. Huh?
You're the first one from the West Coast I heard say that. That's a New York move. You know, that's how they powered their park dams back there.
Right.
You're the first West Coast person to drop some knowledge that we were doing it out here on the West Coast, too.
Yeah. It's a flat plate on the ground. If you pull that plate off, there's two wires. All you got to know is figure out which one is the negative and the positive, and most of the time it don't really make a difference. Plug them to to your extension cord, and you got power, okay? Well, I knew that. My old man was the kind of guy that taught me all kind of stuff. So I'd go out to the park, steal electricity, and I'd play all day long for free just to get the exposure. Records melting in the sun, the records get warping and shit. Oh, it was crazy, dude.
What parks did you do that at?
I did it at Peg Park in right near Palos Verdes. I played Centinella Park. Centinella, Peg Park. Wherever I can plug up at, man. If there was a dance or something like that, I always do the pre-party. The pre-party was how you promoted the dance, okay? Because you got everybody out of the park for free. You pass out your flyers. Everybody got your attention. You got everybody's attention. So you pass out your flyers to your dancers. And if you know, I'm gonna be there. And usually they let me open up at that time, and
I started booking gigs. Not only were you giving dances, but you were also starting to promote printing flyers and doing, you went head over heels into this. You didn't just hire yourself out to DJ.
You know what? I never stopped. Once I saw it was so new.
Right.
You never knew when to stop. You know, you when you became a DJ, you wanted to become a promoter. And if you once became a promoter, you want to start doing concerts. You know, then I got a nightclub. So, you know, as, you know, opportunities kept opening up, man. You know, I was doing my thing. I was DJing on a regular basis. I was one of the few cats that had access to a sound system on a regular basis on my side of town. So I stayed busy.
Okay.
I stayed busy. I had a job working for a record distributor. But, shoot, I got paid in records. I didn't even get paid in money. I got paid in records. And they couldn't figure out how I was eating, coming to work clean every day, driving an almost new van, and not getting no money. You know, I would make
yourself in the early days before you became
I was disco. I was Disco Lonzo, baby.
Disco Lonzo, look out.
Disco Lonzo, dealing you a double dose of disco dynamite, sticking it in your eardrum and blowing your mind. And that was my line, okay? You know? And later on, me and my boy, Roger Clayton, we hooked up and we started doing Dance at the Alpine Village over in Torrance. And later on, after a few dances with him.
Let's pause right there. You and Roger Clayton, for my audience who don't know who he is, he's
right.
The founder of Uncle Jam's Army, premier party promoters, from a later period, but he did start earlier. So you were one of the first people, actually, to work with Roger before Uncle Jam's Army.
Me and Roger worked at the same place, Record Shack, in Compton. We both sold records over the phone. And when he had the idea to even go to Alpine, I'm sitting right there with him. Okay? We're sitting there talking.
What year did y'all did this happen?
This happened like 77.
77. Okay, he was
77.
Still Unique Dreams Entertainment then.
He was still Unique Dreams. He was still Unique Dreams Entertainment. He was what did he call himself? He called himself the Prince of Dreams.
Prince of Dreams. Okay, now that preceded Uncle Jam's Army. Right.
Preceded Uncle Jam's Army. Okay.
And this preceded World Class Records also.
Well, it was actually and truthfully, yes, because we got named the Wrecking Crew at Alpine Village. My company was Disco Construction at that time.
Okay.
I was Disco Construction, Have Sounds Will Travel. That was my mobile DJ company. My card, I still got a business card to say the same thing. Disco Construction, Have Sounds Will Travel. That was named after a gunslinger TV show.
So you sit in the record shop. And how did that ding, the light come on with you and Roger to do the Alpine Village?
He said, man, we ought to do some dances. Because I had a sound system, I had a truck, I'm DJing all the time. We ought to get together and do some dances. What you got in mind, man? Shoot, man, let's do Alpine. All right, let's give it a try, okay? So he went to Alpine and cut the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I started off as just being a straight DJ for him. And then later on, I started doing Alpine myself.
Right.
And I had a partner that Roger's partner turned me on to, a female partner. She and I started doing Alpine together. And shortly after I started doing Alpine, my dad came in the house one day, saw me counting up some money, about $600-$700. Where you get that money from? You know, I got more money in my bedroom than he made all month. He just knew I was selling dope. He was, oh, hell no, you selling dope. You finna die today, okay? And I'm like, dude, no, calm down. And he came to Alpine Village, saw what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I got fired from Record Shack. They laid me off. And then and I told him what I was doing. He took me over to his partner. You still there?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, I heard it click. He took me to his partner that owned this club on Avalon, Jeffy's, and he had just built the second floor, and it was called the Eve After Dark. And my dad helped me to cut my deal for Eve After Dark back in 1979, and we opened up on June 22nd, 1979. And
wow.
That's where that's where a lot of my shit jumped off at, and that was my introduction to hip hop from my perspective. Because now I'm bringing in. Shortly after that, I start brought in Curtis Blow and Run DMC and stuff like that.
And hold on, I want you to paint a picture. When you and Rock, during that period, there was no rapping going on during that period. You guys were, the DJ was the premier thing that brought in the crowd. Am I correct during this period?
Right. The line I just gave you, Disco Lonzo dealing you a double dose of Disco Dynamite, sticking in your eardrum and blowing your mind, that was considered a rap. Okay?
Of course.
That was considered a rap. We didn't have no 16-bar, no 32-bar lines. We had,
right.
as a DJ back in the day, you had to MC your own show.
You
had to have your own sayings. You had to have your own stuff. You just couldn't, wasn't no two DJ. Wasn't no MC and a DJ. You was all that.
There you go. Okay.
You was the MC, the DJ, the road man, the light man. I did my own special effects. I was busy as a doggone octopus. When I DJed the party. Wasn't no two-man shows. It was a one-man show.
Gotcha. Now, Grandmaster Lonzo, you got the Eve After Dark just popping out. And 79, another seminal thing happens which influenced everybody in hip-hop. And I want to see if it had any influence on you. Rapper's Delight comes out.
Rapper's Delight
was a hell of a year. So you can continue.
Rapper's Delight was jumping off right when we opened the Eve After Dark. It came out, right. I think Rapper's Delight came out like September. We just opened the Eve up. I think Rapper's Delight came out September of 79.
Right.
And I tell people this all the time. At this point in time, we are literally we're exiting disco, getting heavy into funk, okay? Because we got the part of the funkadelic, and rap is being introduced.
Mm-hmm.
All this is going on at the same time, okay?
Right.
Now you got Rick James is hot. You got Prince is just coming out. Michael Jackson is doing his thing, just leaving the Jackson 5.
Right.
So then Curtis Blow had just dropped Christmas Rapping. Before Rappers Delight came out, there was Christmas Rapping. I think it came out like 78. So we had heard the rap situation, but we hadn't heard anything. Hadn't got bombarded yet. Okay,
we're
just being introduced. Okay, and everybody thought it was going to be a flash in the pan. And, nobody was really checking for it.
Right. Catches everybody off guard.
Everybody.
But Disco Lonzo, you're a DJ. And this record comes out, you got a nightclub, and you're already DJing. Bing, what happened?
The club business has always been kind of an up-and-down situation. And we saw rap coming to L.A., and one night, for a while, the club slowed down. So I hired a band coming to the club, and we wrote some raps. The DJs wrote some raps. Now, the DJs that wrote these raps never got famous because my initial DJ crew did not consist of Dr. Dre. Dre came in afterwards. We had four other guys that rolled with me. It was a DJ Unknown. Dr. Rock out of Texas, Sweet Ron Ron, and a cat named Billy T. All these guys were my initial DJs for Eve After Dark. So we all sat down and wrote a rap to Rock, Skate, Roll, Bounce, the song by Von Mason and crew. And we would perform that in the club just to try and get some hype on the club.
Okay.
And it worked for the most part, but we never dropped a record. We never released a record. We just made it. It was a club thing. Just something we did in the club. Because we didn't know how to go about making a record. Nobody made a record before. How are we going to make a record? I'm not making no records. So we just recorded it and let it sit, just posted up on it. And I got to find it right now because people still ask about that song. I had to find that record. I got to go in my archives and find that damn song. But make a long story short, it kind of gave us an idea and it put us on the road to becoming a rap group. The guys I had, they were a little bit older guys at that time. I was kind of Unknown was actually the youngest guy.
Mm.
Dr. Rock left and DJ Yella came in. Sweet Ron Ron and Billy T left, and then Dre came in. And when Dre came to the group, it kind of added a different flavor to it.
Well, give us an idea of what was going on, because you, Dre walks in, this person walks in, but there was a progression. Hip hop was on the radio all over L.A. You could get on the bus, you hear people talking about it. If you go over to your friend's house to eat, and the food ain't no good, you see how deeply embedded this music is becoming. So when did rappers? So you got a club. And you probably see you doing your thing with Unknown. And did rappers start coming to you and saying, "I rap"? I mean, how did the discovery process work? You know, did Dre actually just walk in, or you see what I'm saying? How was that?
One of the ways to get the club cracking was to sponsor contests. Mm-hmm. I would sponsor contests. Pop locking contest, breakdance contest, and one of my most popular contests was a rap contest. I was sponsored rap contests all the time. And people didn't have no real fly, but because I started doing that, people started coming out and start participating in the rap contest. And it just,
They gave them a reason to write because they're going to.
They gave them reason to write. Okay, it gave them reason to write, and it just kept growing and growing and growing, man. And just that's how I met DJ Clientele, in a rap contest. He came in with so much bravado and so much style and so articulate. I had to put him. I signed him immediately, dude. You got to come join me. You got to come roll with me now. Okay,
what's up, DJ Clientele? We love you, my brother.
Okay. Yeah. So in doing that. Now, I was already making underground mixes. That was one of my hustles. They call them mixtapes now. We call them bootlegs back in the day. And so I got familiar with the record making process, how to record, how to play them up, do the labels, everything it took to make a record. And then I decided Roger actually dropped the record on me first. He dropped Yes, 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 and some other stuff from Uncle Jam's Army.
Yes,
and because by this time we became two rivals. We were no longer buddies. We were rivals now, you know.
You guys ironically started together.
Right.
But you built your own little mini empires. And so what, 3-4 years later, your rival party promotion people. This is before you opened the club up, though, the rivalry started.
Actually, the rivalry started because I opened the club up.
Okay.
When I first got the opportunity to open the club up, I offered Roger a partnership in the club. I said, "Hey, man, come on, dude, join me in the club." Well, Roger, you have to know Roger to understand Roger. Roger is a smart dude. He's a very smart dude, but he also is one arrogant son of a bitch, okay? And, I ain't going over there on them sherm heads. Them sherm heads. No, man, hell no. I ain't going over there on them sherm heads. But what he didn't understand is I knew all the sherm heads. I knew the niggas. I knew the guys. I knew the people that sold the sherm, the ones smoked the sherm. I'm from that neighborhood. Okay? And I just wanted him to come in and help ease the financial pain and add to the promotional muscle. He turned it down. So shortly, we opened in June, so sometime around September, October, he came in wanting to be a partner. By that time, we was cracking. I didn't need no help, okay? So when I turned him down, he got mad at me. "Oh, man, you a fat cat. Oh, man, how you going to do me like that? Roger, I don't need you to come in and help me split up no money. The heavy lifting's been done already, okay?" And he vowed then, "I'm going to be the biggest promoter of all y'all. Fuck all, excuse my French, forget all y'all. I'm going to be bigger than all y'all." Okay, well, cool, do your thing. And we laughed his ass off, okay? Well, go get your soda and
In a way, that was good because it gave L.A. two powerhouse energies that left a hell of a legacy. You're one of them. But go ahead and continue.
I tell people all the time.
I assume we went
Roger,
from there. Jams
on. Yeah, I tell people all the time, Roger and me and Roger's feud was the nitro and the glycerin that blew up the West Coast.
There you go.
Okay? You had to have that nitro and glycerin to blow up some stuff, okay?
Right.
I was a hater of his. He was a hater of mine. And we both knew that. But understand this. We never fought physically.
Right.
Okay?
Right. It was professional rivalry, basically.
It was a professional rivalry, although sometimes I wanted to kick his ass, okay? I wanted to kick his ass a couple of times, but I chose not to. You know, we had all kind of corporate espionage. You know, I'd go to the flyer man and find out how many flyers he got, or go to the poster shop and get a poster guy in the back, give him a $5 tip to find out how many posters he got. So, that information.
Okay, I gotta have you pause again and illuminate the flyover.
Okay.
Only from LA. Probably person that Roger can speak of, he's not here. But what were the Fly Awards? And you two guys basically instituted that. And how did that work?
The Flyers were our main source of advertising. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Flyers were our main source of advertising.
Give us the years when that started. The wars actually started.
Now, the Flyer War started back in the early 70s with the promoters that came before us, LSD, Z-Car, or LSD, JC2 Productions. So Flyers were the main source of advertising at that time. But as we got into the game, we added posters to the game, the big posters, the telephone pole posters. We claimed telephone poles. And, you know, sometimes you would get your behind really threatened by even thinking about hanging on one of my poles. That was our territory. Everybody had territory, and the idea was to get your posters on the pole as soon as possible, take up that space. And if you can't get no space, you can't get no street time. Can't get no street time, people won't know your events going on.
Right.
So we would fight. It was crucial information to find out how many posters Roger would get or how many flyers we would get. There were only two people that made everybody stuff. The flyer man was a guy named Dale Maynard. He was a friend of mine. And Glenn and Kobe Poster made everybody's posters. Roger made Dale made everybody's flyers. So Glenn would never tell you because he understood the significance of the information. But the little guy in the back, he didn't care. $5, he'd tell you any damn thing.
Okay. So you guys are putting up posters, and then this crew's tearing down other people's posters and replacing. And this gets serious at times.
Big pardon?
It gets serious at times.
Oh, it got very serious at times, man. A few times, I mean, we never put hands on Roger and them. We put hands on a few cats before for snatching on our posters. If you're the rookie, come on, man. You going to be disrespectful? We're going to spank you, okay? And a few times we put hands on, you know, my crew would go to your event and ask you, did you know that you snatched down our posters? Yeah, so what? Okay. Figure this one out, and next thing you know, it would be a nice little rumble because I had some decent cats in my crew, and the poster didn't get snatched down no more. In fact, by doing that, it stopped everybody from snatching our posters. We would put hands on you, okay? We never put hands on Roger, okay? But we came chest to chest a few times.
Right.
Me and Roger had a pass. These other guys, I don't know you, okay?
Right.
And you know, I don't know you. Me and Roger had a pass, so you know, sometimes each one of us would give the other one a pass. We talk static to each other, but we never got physical.
Okay. So that showed up. That showed up. Money was in the game at that time. The posters brought in the income, it was revenue. So you mess with the thing that's generating revenue is very serious. So those are the poster wars.
Right.
You got your club going. Uncle Jam's army is blowing up. So what happens is you decide to go to the next phase. This takes you into where you meet Eazy-E and Dre. Rap is obviously taken over by this time. The DJ is no longer the prominent thing. So you get more heavily involved in forming your rap groups. What kind of process did that happen where you ended up with World Class Records?
Well, you know, while at Alpine Village, because my company name was Disco Construction, a good buddy of mine was teasing me one day. He said, "Who are they, the Wrecking Crew?" And I'm like, "Hey, that sounds pretty good. I'm going to keep that." So it became Disco Construction and the Wrecking Crew. And I got to Eve After Dark. I didn't have to carry equipment no more. I didn't have to worry about, you know, lug and load the truck up every night. We left everything at Eve After Dark. So we didn't need the Wrecking Crew per se. But at some point in time, the Wrecking Crew became bigger than Disco Construction. So I dropped Disco Construction, stayed with the Wrecking Crew, okay? Because the Wrecking Crew sound more, you know, sound more aggressive, the Wrecking Crew. And while I made my first record, I got a cease and desist letter from a lawyer saying we couldn't use the name Wrecking Crew because there was a group out of Chicago named the Wrecking Crew, and they were making big records. So this is 84 now.
Mm-hmm.
And the Olympics came to town. They were in L.A. The Olympics was in L.A., and I kept hearing this term, world-class runner, world-class sprinter, world-class gymnast. And I called my lawyer, "Hey, man, if I had the term world-class, mess the spelling up, would that suffice?" He said, "Yeah, that'll work." So that's how you got Wrecking Crew, world-class, Wrecking, no G, C-R-U.
Okay.
And never had a problem after that. But by this time, we was committed to World Class Wrecking Crew. And we started making our records, man. And, you know, because I used to sell records over the phone to all the stores, I knew everybody. Everybody knew my voice. They didn't know my face. So because I had to deliver the records, they got to know my face. And, you know, now I got all these relationships with store owners. You know, and let me say this for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people all the time, especially youngsters, you don't know where you're going to be in 10, 15 years from now. Treat everybody the way you want to be treated because, you know, here I am right now. I used to be Dre's boss, Dr. Dre's boss, but now I'm going to him to get things done, okay?
Right.
And,
right.
you know, if I had treated him bad, but, you know, because I helped him, I bought him his first car, I bought him his first turntables. I gave him access to my Studio Unlimited. Hey, man, what you need, Lonzo? That's what we are now. What you need?
Okay? Dr. Dre, you're talking about.
That's Dr. Dre, the billionaire Dr. Dre. We hadn't talked in quite some time, and we reconnected. And now we're at the point where, okay, Doc, what you want to do, Lonzo? I'm in a position to help you. Tell me what can I do?
That is beautiful.
These are the things that I tell people all the time, man. You know, everybody want to be a tough ass, want to be gangbangers. I do a lot of coaching with youngsters, and I tell them, man, you're 22 years old. You don't know where your partner going to be in 5, 10, 15 years from now. This is the entertainment business. One good video, one good record can change a whole career path, and they say, you know, a guy that you was beefing with is in a position to help you make some money.
That's right.
Let's get bullshit that. Go and get your money, huh?
Let's get into that. You meet Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, and this is through the Eve After Dark Club. How did that happen?
Now, that right there was a perfect example of what not to do. Everything I just said just now was a perfect example of what not to do, okay? Because when Easy and Dre first came to the club, I gave him a hard time, but I knew Dre. I knew Dre's people. We all grew up on the same street. You know, Dre's dad lived on the same block that I did. I watched Dre grow up pretty much. So when he told me who he was, okay, cool. Doc, I can tell you what. Go home and change clothes. Come on back in. I'll give you a pass. Well, Easy was with him. And Easy was talking static. Oh man, it's Eve at the dark. I ain't gotta go get dressed. No, yes you do. If you wanna come, yes you do. If you wanna come up here, you gotta come corrected. Don't come at all. Okay. And so Dre went home and changed clothes. Came back next week, clean like he's supposed to. I let him in the club. Easy didn't come in the club, so we got into it a little bit. Oh, are you gonna let him in and not let me in? No, Keep your little bummy ass outside, okay? We, you know, we don't do the jeans and T-shirt thing up here. We wear baggy pants and skinny ties up here, okay?
What year is this, Alonzo? It's very important.
This is like 82, 83.
Okay, go ahead.
And eventually, Easy Conformed came to the club, but Easy and Dre came to me. Easy had a production company called High Power Production. Dre was his DJ. The day that Dre came to the club and did his mix, Easy wasn't there. Dre became a part of the infrastructure of Eve After Dark. He didn't come to me directly. He came through Unknown DJ. Unknown had him doing bootlegs for him, bootleg mixes for him, and then later on he came to join me. And I started making legitimate records.
Okay, just take you off point for 1 second. So Dre, what he's famous for now, those mixes, he was doing that from the beginning, basically.
That was the first introduction to the record business, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. That was his first introduction to the record business, were those mixes. And by us doing that, we learned the process of manufacturing records and also the process of distributing records, distributing records on a local basis. Again, I worked for a distribution company. I had a list that consists of every record store from Seattle, Washington to Vegas and all of California. And that was my territory was all of California. So I would, you know, call people up and then everybody in L.A., a lot of times, if I wanted to make the sale, I'd drop it off to them. Okay,
right.
So I had a relationship with people. You know, I would call people up and tell them, "Hey, man, I got this hot product, blah blah blah," and then later on, I start doing the same thing for my product. "Hey, man, I got this new thing. You might want to check out." And you know, it just blew up from there, man. I tell people all the time when I look back at what I went through personally. Okay, it's like God took his hand. You ever had to see a kid with a car and they just guiding around the floor of the house?
Right.
That's how my life has been when it came to this entertainment. I never, ever in my life planned to be this deep in the music industry. I don't play an instrument. Okay?
Right.
I'm not a producer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a great rapper. I can rap, but you ain't going to never see me in no contest. I'm going out and like, if it was a ranking, I'd probably be like the 500,000th best rapper or some stuff like that. You know, my talent was always being able to recognize other talent.
That
was my talent. I have a gift for recognizing talent. And I have a gift for creating situations that can help not only me, other people as well.
Okay.
By having a club at a young age, by being a DJ, people were attracted to me. As you very well know, people become attracted to you because you're a center of attention. People want to be around you.
Right.
Okay? And because at 22 years old, I got a nightclub, guys and girls want to be around. So I was a bachelor. I had a house. Everybody come to my house after the club or on Sunday after the club or Friday before the club. Everybody at my house hanging out, and then, you know, it became, you know, and when I moved into, and I got a bigger house, it even became even more. I got a house and a studio, so 24/7, I got people at my house, I got a studio cracking. It reminded me of that movie with Ike and Tina Turner. What's Love Got to Do with It? When you saw all the people hanging out at Ike and Tina, you know, they had a studio in the living room, everybody singing, sitting around, kicking it. That's the kind of thing that we did back in the day in my house.
Wow.
Okay. I always had a studio. I had a 4-track in my first house. The house I live in now, I had a 12-track, a 16-track, a 24-track. And because I had those studios, and one of the studios you can go to, you know, people would come over here. So I had who of West Coast hip-hop just hanging at my house.
Man. And this leads to the development of not only world-class Wrecking Crew, which I do want you to speak about how you put those guys together, but also provide the way for them to cut their teeth, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, to set the stage for their N.W.A., Not Without Alonzo, niggas with attitude. So let's get into how you put together World-Class Wrecking Crew. What sparked that, first of all, to put the group together? And how did you choose the members specifically for your first group?
Well, I chose the members initially just because they were DJs in the club. That was my first, that was kind of an easy situation, okay? Clientele, like I said, he had won a contest. DJ Yellow was a DJ in the club. Dre came in with that super mix, and I just refused to put money up and not be a part of it. I just couldn't do that. Although I was told by several people, well, you can't own the label to be in the group too. Why not? Is there a law say I can't be in the group and own the label too? No, but it's just Barry Gordy. I said, I ain't Barry Gordy. I'm Lonzo. And this, see, understand this. By me doing that, okay, being in the group, owning the label, okay, that was a direct path for Eazy-E. He saw me do it, so he did it. Okay?
There we go. Now, that's knowledge right there. You were the first example of somebody from the hood who came up from the hood and is doing all of this stuff musically, and you can't play an instrument. He can't play an instrument, you know what I'm saying? And you've got recording equipment.
Right. Now, people don't realize that Eazy never intended to be a rapper. Never. They see it right in front of their faces and don't realize it. Okay?
Okay.
Go to Straight Outta Compton. Eazy was not supposed to be in the studio. The studio that Eazy did his demos in, I just walked out of, okay? I'm sitting on my deck in my backyard. I've been in the studio for the last, this is morning. I still own the same house that Eazy and Dre did all the demos in for NWA. I still own that property, okay? I still live there. So if you remember seeing the movie, Dre had to drag Eazy in the studio, walk him through his part line by line, okay? And then he made it work. Okay, it wasn't he never, again, here's another accidental superstar. Okay, Eazy's a very shy guy. Eazy was very shy. Dre, back in the day, all those guys were shy. Okay, they, you know, if you put them in a room, you know, they were like church mice. You put them in a car, they drive for 40 miles, not say a word, because they were all introverts. After a while, they got out of it. They grew out of it.
Right.
Wow. So, you know, I've always been the loud mouth, okay? I've always been the spokesperson, the front person. And like I said, I grew up like you. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I grew up on the Temptations and all that right there. Ain't no way in the world I'm going to have an opportunity to be out front and, you know, and do my thing, do what I think is my thing, and not take advantage of it. So, yeah, I'm gonna play businessman Monday through Friday, but Friday and Saturday night, I'm on stage with the group.
There you go. Okay.
In fact, it was funny. I did an interview early this year. A lady a magazine. I forgot the name of the magazine. I can't think of it right now. But anyway, a Soul Central magazine. The interviewer says, "Lonzo, well, who's the other Lonzo that ran the club?" I said, "That was me too." You was the same Lonzo that ran the club and in the record? He said, "Yeah." She said, "We always thought there were two Lonzos because you did, you know, so much being done." No, it was one Lonzo doing everything. Okay? It was one Lonzo doing everything. Okay? And because I set that trend, that's how you got your Easies. That's how you got your Puffies. And that's how you got your L.A. Dream Team, because here in L.A., wasn't nobody checking for us hip-hop-wise.
Right.
But we had to create our own labels.
Mm.
Okay, the artist had to be on their own label, and as you very well know, sometimes that was the best way to go, because you had your bad experiences in the past with independent labels, and back then the game was to tie you up as an artist, and if somebody wanted to give you a record deal, then they had to buy this person out of the contract. And what's crazy, that contract, those type of deals still exist today. Guys are getting signed up left and right to bullshit deals.
Yeah.
They're binding. They're binding bullshit deals. And if somebody want to give you some money or give you a contract, You have to buy this guy out who hasn't done a damn thing but handed you a sheet of paper.
Right. Tell us about LA Dream Team. Rudy Pardee, rest in peace. I knew Rudy. You knew him before I did, obviously. But Rudy Pardee, for a short period before he started LA Dream Team, was the DJ for my group, the world famous LA Breakers. So if
I didn't
know that.
That I didn't know.
Right, Snake Puppy knows. But he was the DJ for my group when I first formed it. He came to me and said, you need a DJ. And then I had a breakdance group, and boom, you know, he did that. And then we started getting bookings for just the group without the DJ. But by then, he had already, next thing I knew, his L.A. Dream Team. You know what I'm saying? But tell us about, I'm going to give a shout-out to Rudy because he's not here, and a shout-out to Snake Puppy about their formation in the beginning, what you know about that.
Yeah, I was doing Dudos real strong by this time. I never will forget Rudy came to Dudos. And here, now understand what I'm about to say.
Okay.
We all were homies. Snake and Rudy, Snake Puppy and Rudy worked at Wendy's on Crenshaw and Century.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that's where they met at. Rudy was the manager, so Rudy had business experience. I got to say something quick. This is crazy. That Wendy's was so new to L.A. that Wendy's on Crenshaw and Century kept a line about 20 cars deep for the first month it was open. No, don't lie, okay?
No,
you could not get a burger at that Wendy's.
Right.
Okay?
Because they were from out of the hood.
Right. When Wendy's first touched down, that square ground beef burger had a line 15, 20 cars outside the parking lot. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I move forward, we didn't have the business acclimate to come in and bring paperwork. We just, everything was a handshake deal with everybody at that time.
Okay?
Rudy came to me at Dudo's. Hey, man, I'm making a song called Rockberry Jam. I want you to say your name, Wrecking Crew. Okay, cool.
Hmm.
He asked Unknown. Hey, Unknown was still with me. Hey, Unknown, I'm making this record called Rockberry Jam. I want to put your name in it. So that's why you got, hey, Bubba Rockberry, hey, Bubba Wrecking Crew, hey, Uncle Jams, Bobby Jimmy. At that time, those groups were the hot groups of L.A., and we just, you know, we were competitive, but we weren't competitive to the point where we held each other back. Hey, man, what you need? Go ahead. Do your thing. Okay?
Right.
And, you know, that's how we all worked back then, you know. Dream Team played Dudos. You know, we played together. They had Dream Team was in the house. That record has always been a big record. And Wrecking Crew and L.A. Dream Team used to always compete for who was going to be the big dogs in L.A. And usually, and I never forget, they was on What's Happening. Oh, it pissed me off to no end. Oh, my God. The L.A. Dream Team showed up on What's Happening. Oh, my God. But what I found out, they chose them. They didn't choose us because I had a beard.
Wow.
Yeah. They told we had the same management team. We had we was both managed by Jerry Heller. We asked Jerry. It was Alexander Heller Agency, Maury Alexander, and Jerry Heller, and we were on Jerry Heller's roster. They were on Maury Alexander's roster, and both because of the same company, they pitched both of us together, and they chose L.A. Dream Team only because I had a beard. They wanted. I said I need a razor blade. I shave on the set, okay? But these are the kind of backstories that people don't really understand, that we had the kind of dumb stuff we did back and forth. You know, it was always a friendly competition with L.A. Dream Team and World Class Wrecking Crew.
Okay. Now, I got to interject my little L.A. Dream Team story. First of all, to the audience out there, the man you're listening to, Grandmaster Lonto and Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, truly first generation hip hop pioneer and legend, and the people we're discussing, world class Wrecking Crew and L.A. Dream Team, Rudy Party, who founded that group, is deceased. But they are all first generation certified pioneers here on the West Coast. Now, the last time I saw Rudy, I was hired by Tom Bradley to do the L.A. street scene for 2-3 years as the hip-hop entertainment director. And so I had Run DMC down there. I had Ice-T. And I had Rudy Party. Now, 85 was the last year of the street scene, because when I introduced Rudy Party on, and this had nothing to do with them, they were performing. It was just the last time I saw Rudy. They were performing, and Snake Puppy verified this. In the middle of their performance, a fight breaks out between a Mexican and a black right below the stage. At first, it's two of them. Then it's four. Then it's eight. Then it's 16. Then the whole crowd is battling in the front of the stage. And I jump down off the stage and try to get them to stop. I jump right into the middle. Please, because, you know, I had the mic and I was sort of safe. And they just ignoring me, punching each other out. I climb back on stage. Rudy and them leave the stage. And they've been rioting and spread throughout the night.
Hey, Disco Daddy.
Have any more street scenes from that? But that's my last time I saw Rudy.
Check this out. You was busy that day, right?
Yeah, now, I was.
What happened was that all that what you say is absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
We were that Rudy then was just about to walk off stage. We just got on stage.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. We at Wrecking Crew had just got on stage, okay? And the fight was still a small fight, okay? I'm sitting there laughing because I didn't know nobody else remember this but me, okay? Because I didn't think nobody remember.
Because
I was so pissed off because this was the first time, because we always felt we had a hotter show than Wrecking. We always felt we had a hotter show than Dream. We always felt we had a hotter show in L.A., period.
Okay.
As world class Wrecking Crew.
Wow.
And this was our chance to show LA who was the baddest boys from the city. Okay. Rudy was doing their thing, and we had just walked on stage. We hadn't even got into our song good, and the fight was still small. Okay.
Yeah.
So we tried to go through it, and that something spread like wildfire, man.
Now,
it spread like I'm watching the jump off, and we're trying to ignore it, hoping somebody's going to shut it down. And right in front of me, a girl was dancing, and her beard ended up in somebody's hair. A guy pushed her, and her guy and this other guy got to fighting, and it got crazy so fast.
Now dig this right here.
We get off the stage, okay? We go under the stage, okay? I tell my fellas, hey, man, let's get under the stage. That way, shit jump off, we'll be all right. We climb under the stage. Guess who's under the stage already? LAPD. They under the stage already.
Wow.
I said, hey, what you doing under here with us, man? Oh, man, if they start shooting, they're going to shoot at us first. I said, who will protect and serve us then? Y'all on your own. Oh, man, talk about some punk shit. Okay.
Oh, man. It was a crazy day. Yes, sir. I didn't know you were there, Alonzo.
Dude, I was there, dude. I was there. And it was crazy. I learned two things. Huh?
That was the last time they had a street
scene. It was. I learned two things that day, man. I learned two things. One, that the cops have a move they can do to the horses, and the horse will kick the shit out your ass. Okay, I watched the cops do it.
Ringing out. I think somebody got shot, or there was laying on the ground after they had cleared people away. And I was standing on the stage with Sylvia Cunliffe, who ran General Services, who's the one that hired me to be entertainment director for that day.
Okay.
For past 3 years, as a matter of fact, for the Tom Bradley administration. And I ran over to look at it, and he bumped me with the horse, bumped me back, which I realized all of a sudden, well, damn, if the person is dead, maybe they were just trampled. I don't know. Then naturally, until the investigators get there, they don't want nobody to get near the body. But I was running over since I was on the stage with the mic and the MC to see if they was okay. But, yeah, that horse is powerful, man. He just nudged the horse and hit me with the shoulder and put me back. I crawled back.
Now, also, I had a reporter. I watched this reporter. He was taking pictures of the whole situation, right? And a cop walked past him rode past him on a horse like he was playing polo and hit him with the baton, man. Because they got them extra long batons they have when they be on the horses, right? They got them extra long batons. They like 4 feet long, as opposed to the short ones they have, the nightsticks. They got some longer batons they carry when they on a horse, okay? And this one cop was riding through the crowd like he was playing polo on people's head. He was whop, whop, whop. I mean, between him and the horse, they was doing big damage. I'm watching this cat. A reporter. A reporter was right there. Did you see that? And he filed a lawsuit. I don't know why he never got back to me, but he wanted me to actually testify in court for him to what I saw. Okay, and it was just fucking crazy. It was just that was the craziest day I've ever seen in LA history, man. Outside of the riots
here in LA. Huh? And we're talking to Grandmaster Lonzo now. Lonzo, we got about 5 minutes. I'd like you to summarize what Grandmaster Lonzo is doing today. I know you got a book out, but you're also still heavily involved in a lot of different things in your community. But just bring us up to speed on what's happening with you right now. Grandmaster Lonzo,
my thing right now, along with you and the other hip-hop pioneers, is to get this story out correctly before we all pass on and become a bunch of white people that, you know, came from the valley and, you know, we'll be... You know, somebody else didn't discover what we did, took credit for what we did. That's why I wrote the book, N.W.A., Not Without Alonzo. I got an audio book as well. I'm doing my own documentary. I've been shooting that for the past 2.5 months. I'm doing a bunch of interviews, a few more interviews in a couple of weeks. I just got back with Clientele and Mona Lisa, and we plan to rock this Uncle Jam's Army Reunion next week at the Savoy. I'm also a prostate cancer survivor. So I also do a lot of things for prostate cancer because that's one of those silent killers that's been taking black men out faster than any police or the Klan. And, you know, it's just a matter of if you know what's going on with your body, you can avoid all that. But so many brothers for over the years have been too masculine to even take the exam. But now that the exam – hold on, I got to go inside now. We go back inside. Now the exam has become strictly a blood test. I tell all the brothers, the only thing saved me was the fact that I found out early. Wow. So, yeah, I'm a prostate cancer survivor, advocate, and, you know, I'm trying to do me a few shows, man, to show my grandkids, granddaddy had it going on, you can have it going on, too. And I'm also a mentor and a coach to a lot of artists and young men in the city. I think that's probably one of the biggest things that we miss, and why so many young men and women have gone astray is because nobody has ever taken time to really talk to them and tell them what we did, tell them how we did it. Yeah, it's a little different today, but you still got to have the same kind of drive. You still got to get up out your bed and do something. You just can't expect people to give you shit because everybody wants the same thing. Why would somebody give it to you? I give it to somebody else, okay? And if your ass ain't trying to make nothing happen, why'd I give it to you in the first place?
Right.
Okay? My boy said it best. Was that it?
Go ahead.
My boy said it best. If talent is great, but you got to put hard work with it. But sometimes hard work can exceed talent, okay? If you put hard work in, you can outdo the person with the talent because most people with talent, a lot of people with talent, think the world owed them something because either they can sing, dance, or they're pretty, and they don't go nowhere because they think, oh, every time somebody approaches them with something, they got an attitude. Oh, you know, I need all this, I need this, I need that. Well, somebody that's hardworking gonna get it no matter what because, you know, that's what they do.
That's what they do. Now, where can people go to purchase your book or purchase your music on the internet?
All my music is on iTunes. I mean, I'm sorry, it's on CD Baby. You go to my website, LonzoWilliams.com. My book is available on my website as well as Amazon, Not Without Alonzo, the hard copy and the book. If you want to get an autographed copy, go to my website, LonzoWilliams.com, and you can order directly from me. I'll send you an autographed copy. All my social media is Real Lonzo NWA. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff. I don't do Snapchat or Periscope, but I do the other three basic ones.
Okay. Well, Grandmaster Lonzo, we want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop worldwide. We want to thank you for taking the time to do our show. And we want the blessings to continue to flow for you, my brother. All right?
Appreciate it. Same to you, Doc.
Thank you. Grandmaster Lonzo, you've been listening to him dropping knowledge on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Peace.
Peace.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic. See you next week. Bye.